From NBI Studios, this is Truth and Justice, a crowdsourced investigation in real time. I'm Bob Ruff. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Truth and Justice. For today's episode, as you guys know, throughout this season 16, we've been trying to bring on content creators where we can highlight people that are doing good work in the field, and also trying to really focus on education for our audience. And we've been on this kind of tangent over the last several, about 2 months now, about interrogation techniques. That conversation began with the Richard Allen case and the Delphi murders. And it's led us into further looks into the Reed technique and how false confessions happen. And so for this week, I brought on a special guest, somebody we've never heard from before. And I'm going to let him go ahead and introduce himself and explain all of his credentials. But we're joined today by Professor Alan Hirsch. Mr. Hirsch, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
So can you tell us a little bit about yourself and your background?
Sure. So I'm an attorney by training. I graduated from Yale Law way back when. I won't give you a year and date myself. Clerked for a judge for a year, spent a few years at a government agency called the Federal Judicial Center, and then sort of stumbled into a career in academia coupled with trial consulting. And for the last 20 years, it's a long story that I won't bore your listeners with, but I found myself intrigued by and then involved in and eventually expert in the field of interrogations and false confessions. So I spend a fair amount of my time writing about that subject and testifying about that around the country in cases where someone has confessed, typically a criminal case where they are facing prison time based primarily on a confession that they have recanted. And my job is to educate the jury on why they might have confessed, even if innocent.
Yeah, and that's great because that's right down the line of we've worked several cases that involved false confessions, and we've talked a lot about cases where they were proven false confessions, but there's so many that happen that a lot of people never hear about. Did I read correctly that you've testified? And the number I saw was over 400 cases. Is that accurate?
No, that's semi-accurate with an emphasis on the semi.
Okay.
I did retain in 400 cases.
Okay.
But as you know, most cases plead out. They don't go to trial, or some of the cases, the defense counsel didn't like what I had to say. So I've actually testified, and I think the number is now 61 or 62.
Okay. But you've been retained in 400. And I really like what you just said there, because that's one of the things that, because we work on primarily wrongful conviction cases. You know, when we get into expert testimony, we hear that, if you pay any expert enough money, they'll say whatever you want to say. So I find it very interesting that you say that the defense attorneys didn't like what you had to say. And I assume that means that you reviewed the interrogation and didn't think it was a false confession. Is that right?
Or didn't find anything particularly problematic in the interrogation tactics. Yeah.
Okay. So I want to start a little bit about how, I know you said there's kind of a boring story that led you there, but you know, the people that we've, you know, I'm sure you're familiar with a lot of the folks that we've worked with. We worked with Jim Tranum, Jim Clement. Yep. And we've worked with Jim Clemente, who's a former FBI profiler, who does a lot of statement analysis type work. But how did you go from being a lawyer into this field that where you're so specifically in this niche of false confessions?
So you're forcing me into the story, are you? All right. Well, when I was a law clerk for a judge in the United States Court of Appeals, we happened to have a case involving a confession, and the standard for admitting confessions was at the heart of it. And it went up to the Supreme Court, and it came back down to us and went back up to the Supreme Court, and it was fascinating. And the very idea that there were false confessions intrigued me like it does a lot of people. It was not really on my radar. So it got a grip on me then. And I started studying it a little bit, acquainting myself with it informally. And then by a bizarre, I don't know how bizarre it is, but in any case, a coincidence, I end up at Williams College. And my colleague on the faculty there is Saul Kassin, who happens to be probably the world's leading authority on the subject.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly one of them. And I picked his brain, and my fascination only grew. I started a website devoted to the subject. I started writing about it. One day decided, why not hang out my shingle and offer myself as an expert if anyone dared to try me or to take me up on it. And one thing led to another, and it's been a good fit. And I've been doing it ever since. And of course, my credentials have been bolstered by more writing on the subject and more testifying and the website. So now I do a fair amount of this work.
So do you, there's, I want to talk a little bit about the Reed technique. My audience may be bored to death with it because I've been, you know, we've been going on and on about it for weeks at a time. But I'm going to want to talk about, you know, the Reed technique and peace model, if you're familiar with that, because that's that's one that is, it's just kind of coming onto my radar now as an alternative, but it doesn't seem to be being used a whole lot. But in your opinion, after, you know, researching so many cases and writing about them, when false confessions have, first of all, I'm trying to think of a way to quantify it, and there probably isn't one, but would you say that are false confessions, I guess this is a way to put it, more common than people think?
That's the, you can't quantify it precisely. That data simply isn't kept. Numerous false confessions don't get proven false.
People
are languishing in the prisons having confessed falsely. But it's absolutely the case that they are far more frequent than anyone would have imagined.
Yeah. And it's like you said, when you first started looking, you were intrigued by the fact. And I was the same way the first time I came across one, you know, 10 years ago when I started doing this work, was, you know, I just always have had in my mind that that's ridiculous. No one would confess, especially, you know, we work capital cases for the most part, you know, that no one's going to confess to a murder if they didn't do it. That just doesn't make sense to me. So it's, this is one of the things that the reason I kind of harp on it so much is for people to understand that this is something that does happen. If you were to kind of break it down, what are kind of the main reasons or the causes for false confessions?
Yeah. So here's the elevator pitch. So there are a lot of reasons. Every high-profile crime, people come forward and voluntarily confess falsely, typically for notoriety, sometimes to protect someone else. But the main part of it I'm most concerned with are false confessions that are produced by interrogations. And you may be boring your audience with the Reed technique, but I would love for every American to understand the Reed technique. Because the short version of why there are so many false confessions is that the interrogation method that is most widespread in America predictably causes false confessions. Now, the problem with the Reed technique is that it is too effective. It is a brilliant technique for breaking down guilty people, but it doesn't properly distinguish between innocent people and guilty people. So basically, police lead suspects to conclude that nothing they say will establish their innocence. The cops know they are guilty, and maintaining innocence is futile. And at the same time, they lead them to believe if they confess, it won't be that bad.
Right.
And, you know, I've just summarized a 500-page manual in two sentences. But if you really can just grasp those two concepts, what we call confrontation and minimization, you can begin to understand that an innocent person, like a guilty person, can come to believe that confessing is the best or only way to escape a desperate situation.
And what I like about having the discussions for people to better understand the Reed technique is there's this kind of umbrella of kind of a pool of people that you expect would falsely confess. You know, they're very young. They have, you know, a lower IQ. They're very suggestible. Like, you can wrap your brain around that. Like, oh, you can trick that person into doing it, but certainly not, you know, someone of average or above average intelligence that's, you know, 40 years old. They would never. But the Reed technique, and we've gone through it. We actually just did kind of an exercise in our last episode because I've been talking about it so much in the process. So the two kind of things we were balancing were, and I don't know if I'm sure you're probably familiar with Chris Watts. Maybe not, because it wasn't a false confession, so it may not have come across. He was the guy in Colorado that had murdered his wife and two young daughters and then put him in the oil tank. But his full interrogation is available to watch and listen to. And prior to that, we were looking at the Delphi case, you know, Abby Williams and Libby German in Delphi, Indiana, and Richard Allen's interrogations, where he did not confess. But when we were analyzing that, I was kind of going through the different elements of where you could see where the Reed technique was coming out, where they've got him to a point. They got a story on the record. They confront him with this irrefutable evidence. And in his case, he resisted it. They told him, we know for 100% scientific certainty that this bullet that was found, this unspent round that was found right next to one of the victims, we've proven that comes from your gun. There's no way of getting around it. And, you know, I had talked about during that, that that's usually when they start to move in for the kill. Now you make them feel like they've got no way out.
Yes.
And in his case, he just kept saying, that's not true. And they just kept saying, yes, it is. We know it. And he's like, that's impossible. It can't. And he never broke. But then we kind of, we went into the Chris Watts interrogation where they did the exact same scenario. In his case, it was they gave him a polygraph.
Mm-hmm.
And he came back. Yeah. Yeah. And we just talked about this in our follow-up, how people were asking, did he actually fail the polygraph? And I said, I don't know, and it doesn't matter. They were going to tell him he did anyway.
And you know what? They probably don't know either. I see polygraphs used all the time to elicit confessions. They never look the same. The only thing they have in common, the different polygraphs I've seen administered, and it's now hundreds, is I've never seen anyone pass one.
Right.
Somehow law enforcement always finds that they flunked.
Yeah.
Anyway, I've come to believe that polygraphs are like voodoo, but really they are just an instrument to break people down. They are not an instrument to arrive at truth.
Yeah, and that's how they used it. And now in Chris Watts' case, he was like he eventually fully confessed, led him to the bodies, 100%. We know that he's guilty. So it was interesting to watch the process work on somebody that truly was guilty.
Right.
They tell him you failed the polygraph. We know for a fact you're lying. We know, and they box him into the corner, and then they offer him the way out. Well, maybe mom killed the kids, and then you just it wasn't like you said. It's not that bad.
And they minimized.
They minimized it, and then they brought a family member in. They had his dad come in, and then he confesses that he parrots back the story they gave him to his dad. You know how I love true crime, probably more than most people. But you know what I don't love? Lying in bed at night, thinking about all the details from our cases. I spent hours digging into these stories, trying to understand every twist and turn, and by the time I finally hit the pillow, my mind's racing. I'm staring at the ceiling, wondering if that creak in the hallway is just the house settling or something more sinister. For the longest time, I was waking up groggy, dragging myself through the day, and chugging coffee like it was an IV drip just trying to stay awake. But that cycle, it's finally broken. And the thing that's cracked the case? Beams Dream Powder. Because when it comes to solving the case of your sleepless nights, Dream is a lifesaver. When I found Dream, everything changed. I started sleeping through the night without tossing and turning. I woke up energized instead of foggy or sluggish. And that alone has been a total game changer. Because when I'm tired, it's not just about feeling groggy. My brain just doesn't work. It makes it harder to do my job. But Dream is made with a powerful blend of all natural ingredients. Reishi, magnesium, L-theanine, apigenin, and melatonin. It's designed to help you fall asleep and stay asleep and wake up feeling amazing. And unlike other sleep aids, there's no next day grogginess. Just great, restful sleep. And here's the kicker. It tastes amazing. Seriously, it's not part of my nightly routine. I mix it up, wind down, and by the time my head hits the pillow, I'm already fading out. Since I started using Dream, my energy is back, my focus is sharp, and I feel like I'm actually living my life, not just surviving the day. And I'm not the only one. Beam has already improved over 17.5 million nights of sleep, helping people across the country wake up and feel their best. And here's the twist. Beam's giving our listeners an exclusive offer up to 40% off their best-selling Dream Powder. That's right, up to 40% off to finally crack the case of your bad sleep. Go to shopbeam.com/truth and use code truth at checkout. That's shopbeam.com/truth and use code truth for up to 40% off. Because better sleep? That's the kind of mystery you can solve.
Drivers who switch and save with Progressive could save hundreds. With that kind of money, you could go big time on a fancy water bottle with ultra-titanium alloy metal. You're not sure why you need all that. I mean, it just holds water. But you're getting it anyway. Because if you're hiking near an active volcano and you accidentally drop the bottle into molten lava, your water will still be icy cold. Switch to Progressive and you could save big time. For water bottles. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and affiliates. Not available in all states. Potential savings will vary.
So, you know, what's interesting is, and you say he was demonstrably guilty. And that's the thing about the Reid technique. People say to me, if it's producing all these false confessions, why in the world would law enforcement continue to use it? Are you a conspiracy theorist? No, the Reid technique is really effective. It does break down guilty people. And they just haven't taken the full measure of the fact that it also can break down the innocent. And by the way, the first story you tell where he was confronted with this bullet, they had him dead to rights. I assume that was false, what they were telling him, right?
Well, it's squishy. I think it's false. So what it was is ultimately what we find out as a firearms analyst through a series, it's a long story, but they ejected 6 rounds from his gun because it was unspent and none of them matched. And then they fired 4 rounds from his gun. And one of those 4, they were able to say it had sufficient agreement with his gun, even though it was shot instead of, but they also found the same thing with another gun. And basically by the time we get to trial, we find out pretty much any gun of that make and model would have produced the same results.
Right. So it was flimsy. The point I'm making is people are surprised to learn that cops are allowed to lie to suspects.
Yeah.
And that by itself is not a basis for the confession being kept out of evidence. Mm-hmm. And they routinely do.
Yeah. Yeah. And they were definitely lying to him in the fact that they were telling him it's indisputable, scientific, it's proven. I don't know why you're arguing me that type of thing. But it's interesting to me to watch, because I think people, you know, they hear podcasters, other people talking about the Reid technique, but it's interesting when they get to see it, how it is step by step by step the same thing. Because somebody had asked me in our follow-up episode, well, this wasn't a good example because in this case, it's a family annihilator. And in that case, it was, you know, a stranger murder. And what I was trying to explain is just what you said. The Reid technique does not distinguish. It's you go through these steps. And obviously, you know, the book, I have the textbook too. It says in page 1, it's psychological warfare.
Yeah.
That it's made to break you down.
Yeah. And amazingly, one, I wouldn't say untold aspect of the story, but insufficiently emphasized aspect of the story, is the reason the Reid people are willing to use this method routinely is they claim they don't interrogate innocent people. So part of their training is figuring out who's innocent basically by looking at their, gauging their body language, asking them a few standard questions. And the only problem with this is that it's hooey.
Right.
It just doesn't work. Study after study shows that humans are poor lie detectors.
Yeah.
But we guess we'll get it right about half the time. And if we are trained in the Reid technique, you know how much we'll get it right? About half the time. We might as well flip a coin. That means predictably a very good many of the people they interrogate are in fact innocent, but they are subject to these tactics which are brilliantly designed to break people down.
And I think there's a good spot for us to kind of transition into, because this just came up. Someone just asked me last night about it's getting to be more and more widely known. And I've certainly been screaming it from the rooftops forever that the Reid technique is so dangerous and that it coerces these false confessions. We had a whole, because there's this whole ethical discussion around it too, because you look at a case like Chris Watts that I was saying, and you're like, but it works. Mm-hmm. You know, like that was a guilty person. And because of the Reid technique, we got it. So there's that like, yeah, but it also leads to these false confessions. They ask, is there a better alternative? And we started looking at the Peace Method. I don't know a lot about it other than, you know, just reading a little bit about it. Can you explain the Peace Method and where maybe that is being put in?
Well, primarily in Great Britain.
Uh-huh.
And the acronym is Prepare, Engage. I can't remember the whole thing, but the gist of it is it's a lot less accusatorial. It's more evidence-based. See, this is one of the big problems with the Reid technique, is they know you're guilty, so the whole purpose of the interrogation is to break you down.
Right.
Peace is all about discovering whether you are guilty.
It's information gathering.
Exactly. It's more information-based. And I'm going to greatly oversimplify it, but the interrogator, I don't even know if that's the right word for it, the interviewer, will talk to the suspect, develop a rapport, talk about the real evidence in the case, ask if the suspect's able to explain it, and through that process, try to gather more information. You're then investigating independently to gather more information, which you can then ask him to explain. And it's a method thereby of trying to arrive at truth, not trying to break someone down. Now, you end up in the same place if you succeed.
Right.
But there are these safeguards so that you're much, much less likely to break down the innocent.
Yeah. And it seems to me from what I've read about it is, whereas the Reed technique, the 100% from page one to the end, the goal is a confession, as opposed to the peace method, where it is, the goal is simply to find the truth.
Exactly.
Yeah. So even if it's not even I like that the information gathering piece of it, where it's like, we're just trying to get information so we can then go investigate.
Right.
And find evidence.
Right. Well, and in fact, so you can continue to investigate.
Right.
Because one of the other things is, peace is not sitting people down because they're slouching or they look like they're lying. You know, investigate first, interrogate second is a great rule of thumb. And sometimes even the Reed people will pay lip service to it. But in reality, getting a confession is a shortcut. It saves you all the trouble of investigating a case. So you start with a hunch, you round up the usual suspects, you, for whatever reason, you have people in front of you, just maybe might have done it. You then decide that they did do it based on some flimsy, you know, it's called behavioral assessment analysis, but I call it voodoo. And then you engage in this technique for breaking people down. Yeah, the English, their approach is just completely different. They used to do something like that, and they came to realize that they lacked confidence in the confessions they were getting.
Yeah, that makes sense. And doesn't in the UK, don't they have, aren't there other safeguards in place too, where if somebody does confess, kind of a checklist they have to go through?
Yeah, there are a lot of safeguards, both pre and post confession. And it's special protections for juveniles, all sorts of things.
Yeah. And in juveniles in particular, with the Reed technique, is, you know, when you really break down how it's meant to break you down, and then you put a 15, 16, 17 year old mind in that chair.
Well, that leads to the great point that you made earlier, because it's not just young minds and mentally ill minds and cognitively disabled people. Those populations are overrepresented among false confessors, but collectively they account for roughly a third of proven false confessions. That still leaves two thirds, which are just people of normal intelligence, normal age, normal backgrounds, normal mental health. It can break anyone down.
Right. And so, and you'd said that you actually testified in over 60 cases as an expert. And I presume if the defense is putting you on the stand in those cases, it's because the opinion you came to was that it was in fact a false confession.
Not necessarily. There are cases where, regardless of what I think of the ultimate truth of the confession, and many times I don't know, you know, there's a lot of evidence out there I'm not privy to, but I'd be able to identify problems with the interrogation.
Okay.
You talked about the Chris Watts case. If I had been retained, I would have been willing to say to the jury, look, they did this is how they used the Reed technique, and that's a risky technique. That would all be truthful.
Right. Just somehow to just, in some of those situations, just to try to, as the defense, it's their job, is to try to get some doubt into the jurors' minds.
That's their position. And my feeling is, anytime I can educate anyone, judge, jury, prosecutor, I'm happy to do it.
Yeah, absolutely. And then, do you have kind of a number off the top of your head of how many cases you've testified in where you truly believe this was indeed a false confession?
So that's a great question. I would say, if putting aside cases I testify in, which, that gets sorted out for different reasons, the cases that go to trial and so forth. But of the 400 cases I've been retained in, they fall into three buckets. And I don't keep a running tab, but I think they fall into roughly three equal categories. Those where I'm pretty convinced the person is innocent, those where I think there's a very good chance they're guilty, and those where I am legitimately agnostic. I just don't know.
Right. Of the ones where you're pretty convinced that they're innocent, and maybe if they make it beyond just the retaining phase, but all the way to trial, what have you noticed as far as the juries, how that is received?
Well, you know, I lose sleep over what I'm about to discuss, which is the cases where I was convinced the person was innocent. I laid it all out why, and they're convicted.
Right.
So put aside my personal experience for a moment. There are studies of proven false confessions where the case went to trial. And post-trial, the confession was proven false. DNA after the fact or something else made it 100% obvious the person was innocent. And when those cases went to trial, roughly 75% resulted in convictions. And I would say that tracks with my experience very well. I would say the cases where I've testified where I was pretty, at a minimum, convinced that there was no guilt beyond reasonable doubt. Okay. At a minimum, convinced that a verdict should be not guilty. Roughly 3/4 of the time, those cases resulted in convictions. And I'm not proud of that, but that's just the sad reality.
It's not surprising to me. Yeah. And as you, someone who's been in that seat for as many times as you have, why do you think that is?
Well, the short reason, Bob, is the intuition that an innocent person wouldn't confess is so powerful that it's just an enormous uphill climb to convince someone that the person in front of them who confessed is innocent. What's interesting is when I started doing this 20 years ago, many interrogations were not videotaped.
Yeah.
And a lot of us clamored for videotape interrogations. The jury needs to see what preceded the confession. They need to see the read technique.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was a great idea. I'm glad we did it. It's a big positive step in the right direction. But I think we all overrated the extent to which it would work in terms of preventing wrongful convictions. Because to some extent, seeing is believing. So what I see is, wow, there is a paradigmatic case of the read technique. I sure understand why that innocent person confessed. What lay people are primarily seeing is someone confessing.
Right. And that's what we've seen that, you know, for my audience, we've been talking about it for months, but the Richard Allen case from the Delphi, in that case, we talked about that bullet. There was a case that was completely void of physical evidence.
Right.
And it was a situation where we know he was there that day. He had went to the police and told them, yeah, I was at the bridge that day, but I didn't kill the girls. He held up through his interrogations, everything. But when he was in prison, they actually put him in a prison pretrial. In solitary confinement, he was having all kinds of mental issues, and he started confessing over the phone to his wife. But the confessions were as much as, I did it, I did it, I think I did it. And she's like, no, and then he got convicted pretty quickly. The jury wasn't out very long, and there's a lot of people that can't get past it. He very well may be guilty. I don't know. I'm not claiming that's a wrongful conviction, but it was just, what was interesting to me was people's reaction to it that are so strongly convinced he did it. And when you peel all the layers off, the only evidence against it, the only real evidence against him was the fact that they heard him say out of his mouth, yeah, I did it.
Yeah, well, the gold standard of evidence in today's world. One thing I'd say, I don't know if you've talked to your audience about internalized false confessions where the suspect actually comes to believe they committed the crime, even though they didn't. Or at least comes to think that they may have. So I don't know if that was possible with him. But after being told by the cops that they had the bullet and they knew it was him long enough, he may, especially if he has mental health issues or cognitive issues, he may have actually come to believe that he might have done it, even though he may not have. So that would be one thing I would have wanted to explore with respect to what he told his wife.
Today's episode is sponsored by First Form. All right, I'm almost there. I am 1.2 pounds away from hitting a massive milestone in my life. At 46 years old, over the course of just over 2.5 years, I am 1.2 pounds away from having dropped 100 pounds. I want you to think about that for a minute, especially those of you that have been struggling with weight loss for years, especially when we start to get a little bit older. I'm telling you, when I was 43 years old, I felt like that was just it. I was never going to lose the weight. I tried everything. Nothing worked. I was convinced that my metabolism was broken or whatever the internet was always saying about people when they get older. Then I discovered First Form. For any of you who have seen me over the years, seen me in pictures or met me in person at meetups, you've seen the change. This isn't just some ad I'm reading. I was over 300 pounds and incredibly unhealthy. And it wasn't for lack of trying. I tried every diet and every workout program that was out there. It seemed like nothing worked. But I started my journey with the First Form app in 2022, in October. Now, they have a long list of supplements that I use and protein bars and protein shakes, all that stuff. But what I want to talk about today is the app. That's what got me started And that's what got me actually moving and had me start losing weight, not just a little bit here and there, not some yo-yo diet where I would crash and then put it back on, but I started consistently over months and months losing weight at a rate of, at first, 5 to 10 pounds a week. This is how the First Form app works. You set it up, you put in all of your body metrics, your age, what your goal is, and it creates a nutrition plan designed just for you and your goals. It'll tell you how many calories you need to eat per day, and it breaks down the macros. That means, out of those calories, how many grams of protein should you eat? How many grams of fat? How many grams of carbs? How much fiber should you eat? All things that I never thought mattered. I always felt like calories in, calories burned, that's how you lose weight. But when I started using the app, number one, I had purpose and I had focus. I started tracking everything I eat, which I know seems daunting to track everything, but it's way easier than you think. It kind of becomes addictive after a little while, to be honest with you. At least it did for me. Almost anything you eat, anything that has a barcode, you can just scan in the app and it will preload all those macros and calorie counts for you. So if I get up in the morning and I want to have some oatmeal, I just take out the packet of oatmeal, scan it, it pops it into my breakfast. If I want some milk in it, I just scan the jug, tell it I'm putting a half a cup into my oatmeal, and it factors all of the macros right in there for me. Keeps a running tally and tells you how many of each macro you've had, how many you have left, and you can just plan it throughout your day and you track everything. And it makes your eating purposeful. You're actually paying attention, which for me was a huge part of it. I felt like I was eating healthy, but I really wasn't. All those little snacks, that extra apple or extra whatever that I would eat, I didn't really think about those things. But when I started tracking everything, I started seeing where my weaknesses were. And when I started paying attention and I started following the nutrition plan that the app set up for me, I started shedding weight consistently. And that's the last thing I'll leave you with, because I'm already running a little long here, is that First Form is designed to be sustainable. Think back to, I don't know, any diet you've ever tried. What always happens? Basically, it has you starve yourself, do a crazy workout, and over the course of 6 or 8 weeks, you lose a bunch of weight and you start feeling great and you take your before and after pictures, but you can't keep eating like that. No one can. So you eventually binge and crash and go right back to where you were before. You feel worse about yourself. And then the same company that told you the last workout plan suddenly has a brand new one that you can buy from them. And you start the cycle all over again. It's not how First Form works. And I am the proof. October this year will be 3 years that I've been using First Form, and I have just been consistently going down, 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 and building muscle along the way. I'm more fit now than I was in my 30s. I talked about this a few weeks ago, but I even lost my wedding ring because I weigh 30 pounds less now than I did when I got married 13 years ago. And my wedding ring just fell right off. The point is, you can make a change today that will work long-term for you to lose weight, even if you're in your 40s, even if you think nothing else works. You need to try it out. And this is the best way to do it. Just go to firstform.com/truth and go ahead and try out some of their supplements. I would recommend their multi-factor vitamins, or their protein shakes, or definitely their protein bars. They're like the best protein bars you've ever tasted in your life. And any order you spend over $75 are going to give you free shipping. But if you're a new customer, they're also going to email you a link and let you try out the First Form app for free for a month. So you'll have a month with some of these great supplements and the app to set up your nutrition plan for you. You can see how it works. And I promise you, if you stick to it, and if you're anything like me, if you stick to it, do what the app tells you to do for that free month, you're going to see results. And you're not going to want to stop. So give it a try. Make the change today. One more time. That's firstform.com/truth. That's the number one, STPHORM.com/truth.
Drivers who switch and save with Progressive could save hundreds. With that kind of money, you could go big time on a fancy water bottle. With ultra-titanium alloy metal. You're not sure why you need all that. I mean, it just holds water. But you're getting it anyway. Because if you're hiking near an active volcano and you accidentally drop the bottle into molten lava, your water will still be icy cold. Switch to Progressive and you could save big time. For water bottles. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and affiliates, not available in all states. Potential savings will vary.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Can you explain a little bit more about that? Because I've actually never even heard that term, false confession.
Right. So there are actually three categories of false confessions. The first I mentioned earlier, the voluntary false confession. The second, what we've been talking about mostly, and probably what you've been talking about mostly these many weeks, which is the coerced false confession where the person knows they're innocent.
Yeah.
But believes it's the way of escaping this desperate situation, the only or best way out. But there's also this third category, which is intriguing. But we know there are cases of them, quite a few documented cases of internalized false confessions, where a suspect told repeatedly by law enforcement that he's guilty, they know he's guilty, they have irrefutable evidence of his guilt, begins to wonder, if they have irrefutable evidence of the guilt, of my guilt, is it possible that I am guilty but forgot or repressed the memory of it or had a blackout? Mm-hmm. So this will typically happen with people who have reason to mistrust their memory. And then they come to make tentative admissions. I may have done it. I think I did it. I must have done it. And then, amazingly enough, over time, some of them begin to fill in the gaps of their memory with recovered memory, it's sometimes called, and they will give a full account of what happened, even though it's all fictional.
Right.
Now, often something they've acquired from law enforcement. They've been supplied this information and it lodges somewhere in their brain and they spit it out as if they knew it. So anyway, there's always that to contend with, and the possibility of an internalized false confession.
That's fascinating. And in that one particular case, as I'm thinking through, and again, I have to keep stressed because people get mad at me because people are very, very emotional about that case. But I don't know if he's innocent or guilty, but it was for me, when I was analyzing his interview, it just from my years of working with Reed Technique and all that, it was jarring to me how well he held up, right? So
yeah,
is there, in your experience of it, obviously mountains more than I've ever had, is there, at what point in the Reed Technique would you say, is there a particular point where you usually see the shift, where you can start to say, oh yeah, they're going to confess, they've got him on the hook now?
No, I wouldn't say there's a silver bullet or some magical moment. That really varies from case to case. There are different things that break people. I will say that the seventh step in the Reed manual is presenting people with an alternative scenario where they flat out give them two choices, such as you're either an evil predator or you made a mistake.
Right.
Which is it? And that is surprisingly effective. Mm-hmm. So there are times where I hear that and I brace myself, and lo and behold, that's when the suspect begins to crack. But everyone has a different breaking point. To your case, which I'm not terribly familiar with, you mentioned that there's no evidence except the confession, more or less.
No strong. And, I mean, there's witnesses that saw maybe somebody dressed like him.
Yeah.
But there's nobody that said, I saw him with those girls. There's no
limited direct evidence.
Yeah,
I just can't recall. He never really does break down. The only confession is what he gives to his wife. I did it
over the phone in prison. Yeah, and then there's
I want to see a confession lead the cops to evidence.
Right.
Or at least state evidence that only the perpetrator would likely know.
Yeah.
But a mere I did it is obviously very thin.
Yeah.
If that is not accompanied by any meaningful direct evidence, I want to tell your listeners who are so furious at you that they shouldn't be. That, you know, you're saying you don't know that the gentleman is innocent, and that's appropriate. But you certainly should be skeptical of a mere I did it unaccompanied by serious corroboration.
Yeah. I'm actually so glad you said that, because when I was explaining that, so I went through an episode where I went through all of his confessions, because this happened multiple times. And I said, with every one of those phone calls, I was like, I don't call this a confession. Just him saying I did it with no narrative, no beginning, middle, and end, no evidence. The kind of nail in the coffin for him was this weird hearsay situation where there was a prison psychologist who was meeting with him, who then testified that he confessed to her. And relayed kind of a narrative. There was all kinds of, she got in all kinds of, because as it turns out, she was like on message boards talking about the case before she was like obsessed with the case. Who knows if it's legit or not, but that was the only, kind of narrative confession, but we never heard it from him. We heard it from her.
You don't have to be a psychologist to imagine all kinds of motives for him telling his wife he did it.
Yeah,
it may have been to taunt her. It may have been to appease her. It may have been to amuse himself. As I said, it may be because he was having some doubts as to whether he did do it. It's just, I understand people hear those words and they leap to conclusions, but the more time you spend in this field, the more time you know that words alone should not send a person to prison for life.
Right. And that whole idea of the internalized false confession, like I want to go back and listen to them again because,
yeah,
like I said, I wasn't familiar with it, but it was, in my mind, it was, I mean, he was having a mental, I mean, he was eating his own feces and I mean, he was out of his mind when this was going on. He was in really bad shape. But I still want to think, oh, because of that mental state, he was in his mind, there was a purpose he was doing this. I hadn't considered that purpose might be that he might have believed it.
Yeah. Well, that's even more counterintuitive than most false confessions.
Right.
But interestingly enough, there are even laboratory experiments that kind of corroborate that phenomenon. Actually, I don't know if you want to hear. I'm mindful. So college students were given this task. This is an experiment in a liberal arts college. It happened to be the one that I taught at. I didn't conduct the experiment. But they're told they're just doing data input on a computer. But they are warned that they better not, whatever they do, hit the alt key. Because if they do, it's going to cause the computer to crash. And they start typing away, and lo and behold, the experimenter charges in and says to them, oh my God, you hit the alt key, the system crashed. And of course, these people all deny it because they didn't, in fact, hit the alt key. But then a certain percentage of them there's a confederate of the experimenter who's in the area who says, oh no, I saw you. You hit it. And amazingly, most of them confess. Now,
wow.
People will scoff at this. Confessing to hitting an alt key is not the same thing as confessing to homicide. There aren't these consequences. It's one thing to believe you made a mistake with your typing, another thing to believe you killed people. Here's the remarkable thing about it, is in the debriefing process, a non-trivial number of these people actually believed they did it. They didn't just say it to get the experimenter off their back. I think it was 28% actually came to think, look, if you got a witness telling me I did it, I did it. But here's the really remarkable thing, because it's still the case that that's not a scenario like committing a crime, okay? It's obviously a lot more plausible that you accidentally hit a key than that you committed a crime without knowing it. But 9% constructed a narrative around how they hit the alt key. They explained how it happened. They actually clearly believed they did it. They internalized guilt, and they even came to think they know how it happened.
That's fascinating. And like you said, it's a simple experience without a lot of consequence, but there's still, to me, the part that fascinates me isn't the severity of it or the consequences. It's the what happened to them psychologically.
Yes.
That you, like, the ability that for you to make someone believe that they did something that they didn't do.
Right. That's the remarkable thing about the experiment in my mind, is the internalization factor. It's the idea that people, and again, I emphasize this because to me this is mind-blowing, not only come to believe they did something they didn't do, but come to have an idea of how it happened. They explain how they did this thing that they did not do. Now, of course, in your case, Richard Allen, he didn't do that. He didn't explain how it happened, but he still could very possibly internalized guilt from what you've told me.
Yeah. Well, and that makes so much more sense, too, because as the conversations go on, because his wife's like, no, you didn't. I know you didn't. And he's like, yes, I did. But then in a few of the conversations, he goes around and he's like, well, but what if I did? But what if I did? And he's like giving the, which, you know, I kind of took at the time to mean like, well, would you still love me if I did?
Yeah.
Like, what if? But it's, I wonder if he's like thinking in his mind, like, but
yeah,
but
maybe I did. Yeah. I mean, absolutely. I don't know if you know much about his psychological state, but is he someone who would have had reason to question his memory?
No, I don't think so. I mean, yeah. he did have like some anxiety issues and some other issues, depression, but yeah, nothing. Because like you were talking about, there is, you know, I know people are kind of vulnerable to that type of thing if they're, you know, abusing substances, or if they,
right,
you know, they have reason, you know, they were drunk that night. So maybe,
exactly,
I didn't know, something along those lines. There was nothing like that.
Yeah. Absent any of that, you know, I'd say an internalized false confession is less likely, but I certainly wouldn't rule it out.
Yeah. That's fascinating. Well, I want to move, before we close things out, I noticed you haven't put out any episodes for about a year, if I was looking at the feed right, But the few of them that I listened to, I'm hoping you're going to come back to it. So Alan actually hosts a podcast called The Truth About False Confessions. How did that come to be? And is it coming back?
I don't know is the answer to that question. See, you would know better than I. It's hard work to
put together a
podcast. And I'm just going to guess that you have a staff. Okay. So for me, it was deciding that, you know, I'm in the 21st century. I'm trying to educate people. I'm trying to communicate about this important subject. That's the next step, is to do a podcast. But it's really a mom and pop operation. My daughter is a very talented music theater composer, does the little bits of music. My son did the producing, and I did the research, writing, and presentation. But given the lack of a support staff, it's just not easy for me to put all that together, given the, you know, the other demands on my time. And for that reason alone, I can't promise it will come back. But it was enjoyable to do, and it got a good reception. And I would encourage your listeners, if they're tempted to listen to the Truth About False Confession podcast, to start with the Skylar Richardson episode. Mm-hmm. It's a tough listen. It's about a teenage girl accused of bury her child in the backyard, but allegedly killed the child before burying it. The reality, and a jury found this too, is the child was stillborn, but it's a deeply disturbing and fascinating case. And that might be a place people should start.
Yeah, check it out. And like I said, I've listened to a couple of the kind of two most recent ones. They're fascinating. They covered cases. And I think for my audiences, you know, always looking for places to get educated, go check out The Truth About False Confessions. That's it's Alan breaking down some. Were these all cases that you worked on or just cases that you researched?
So I believe all but one were cases I was involved in.
Okay. Yeah. And check that out. And then maybe a little spike in listeners might get Alan to get the band back together. And
not impossible.
It'll be great. And the last question I have for you is, you know, when we start digging into our cases, we do long form investigations of wrongful conviction cases. And over the last decade, I've, you know, accumulated this pool of experts where we have certain, you know, elements that come up, or we can have people look at things and come on the show and talk about them. Could I add you to my list the next time we have a false confession to look at?
Easiest question of the night, of course.
That's fantastic. Well, Alan, thank you so much. It's been great talking to you, and I'm going to find another case I need you to work on just so I get a chance to chat with you again.
Anytime, Bob. I really appreciate it.
All right. Thanks so much. Truth and Justice is an NBI Studios production, co-written and produced by Erica Bergenham. Music for Season 15 is created and composed by Caden Ladislaw. Follow-up episodes are co-hosted by Janet Varney and Zach Weaver. Our logo font was created by Tate Krupa of Red Swan Graphic Design. Our website is created, managed, and maintained by Katie Ross of createdintandem.com. Thank you to our volunteer transcription team, Erica Cantor, Kathy McElhaney, Courtney Wimberly, Kay Wood Yomnick, Danielle Rohr, Jennifer Athey, and Caroline Dwyer. Truth and Justice provides all investigative and advocacy work for the wrongfully convicted completely free of charge. We're able to do that in large part thanks to you, our listeners, through your generous pledges on Patreon. Patreon accounts for the overwhelming majority of our funding. The number one way you can support our work is to become a patron at patreon.com/truthandjustice. For just $5 a month, you'll get all episodes ad-free, a bonus pregame episode every Wednesday, and also a video version of the Friday follow-ups exclusive to our patrons. Patrons also get to participate and join the chat live in many of our interviews and get early access to much of our content. Just go to patreon.com/truthandjustice to sign up. You can also help us out by going to iTunes and leaving us a 5-star rating and review. It doesn't cost you a penny and goes a long way towards making the show more visible. If you have a new case that you'd like us to consider, you can submit your cases on our website, truthandjusticepod.com. Just click on the case submission button and fill out the form. You can always keep in touch with us through our email at theories@truthandjusticepod.com. You can like our Facebook page or join in on the conversation on the official Truth and Justice Podcast fans page. You can also connect with us on social media platform X @truthjusticepod. And to follow our personal accounts on social media, I can be found at Bob Ruff Truth. Janet can be found at Janet Varney, and Zach is at Z to the Q. However you do it, stay engaged and stay in touch. But as for now, we're signing off. I'm Bob Ruff.
I'm Zach Weaver.
And I'm Janet Varney.
And this has been Truth and Justice.